Okay, so the Industrial Revolution and the Empire. Remember, you have to listen carefully and take notes, yeah? Yeah, remember that. Okay, and I will repeat the information about the class, the other class at the end. So next Tuesday the 16th at midday, not midnight, midday. Okay, so the Industrial Revolution and the Empire really is the reason why you are here. Because if the Spanish had built a bigger empire than the British, you would be in Crete learning Spanish. It's because of the British Empire, and in particular the United States, because they speak English, that's probably why you're learning English, except for a few people. So, interesting questions to look at concerning the Industrial Revolution and the Empire are why and how. So, why Britain? Britain is a small country with very bad weather. And nevertheless, Britain had the biggest empire in history. 1/4 of the world's population was in the British Empire in 1914. 1/4 of the land area of the world was the British Empire. The jewel of the empire was India. India, more than 100 million people, 150 million people, controlled by a small country like England with 35 million people. So the first question we might think about is why. But I'm going to begin. I'm going to begin with the Industrial Revolution in Britain, because of course it is because Britain had more advanced industry and more advanced military technology that it was possible to dominate the world, and more advanced naval technology. These are the three elements which are very useful. The first part of the Industrial Revolution in Britain, after 1700, was the Agricultural Revolution. That is to say, the old traditional way of organising land was transformed by the enclosures. That is to say that land which previously belonged to nobody, or belonged to everybody, was privatised and taken by the big landowners. They thought it was a good idea. They said, look at this land, it is inefficient. It is not being used in an efficient way. We want to use new technology to produce more food and so on. This was particularly difficult for people who had no land, who had no documents to prove they had some land. And this is what forms the millions of people, pushes them out of the countryside into the towns, and they will become the industrial working class, which we read about in Dickens and so on. There is resistance. For example, in 1811, a whole series of machine-breaking riots where the people who are used to working at home, making a difficult living, but making a living at home, are suddenly in competition with the first factories, and it's impossible for them to make a living. It's also impossible for them to organise a trade union. It's illegal. So what do? They go in the middle of the night and they break the machines, thousands of machines. This is the machine-breaking riots of 1811, 1812. And another resistance in 1830, the Captain Swing movement. All across the country for 6 months, a whole series of revolts. First of all, for wages. This is mostly agricultural workers, people who work on the farms for money. Secondly, against the church, not because they are against religion, but against the taxes demanded by the church. And thirdly, against the organisation of the poor laws. Very, very cruel way of dealing with the poor. They would give you something to eat, but in return, you had to do humiliating work. You had to replace horses, for example, in pulling things, just because of the ideology which said that, you know, if you're poor, it's your fault. Is that a question there?
No, what's the date when they broke the machines?
The biggest, there are a lot, yeah, but the big wave of machine breaking is 1811, 1812. Okay, so the Agricultural Revolution, better technology, better irrigation. The Transport Revolution, Because we think of the Industrial Revolution, we think of factories and machines, and factories and machines are important. Also the Transport Revolution. The Transport Revolution, you need good roads. To have an Industrial Revolution, you need good roads. And the roads were very, very bad. And the solution they found was to privatise the roads. You can control the road from Leeds to Manchester, and everybody who takes the road must pay. Now, privatisation of the road, this is called the turnpike. A little later on, the canals. They dug the canals, especially a lot of Irish workers came over to England and dug the canals. England had an advantage. It's not very big. The canals do not have to be very long. And finally, of course, the railways. The railways are first in Britain, and the railways transform all kinds of commerce. It is much, much, much cheaper to build a railway for 100 miles than to dig a canal and fill it with water and clean it. Yeah, the railways is a wonderful thing. There was a railway boom. It was very chaotic. There were 100 railway companies. There were 5 different widths of rail. Yeah, it was such a big chaos. Yes, one company produced rail like this and another company rail like that. They couldn't use each other's trains. But the end result was that Britain was the first country with railways, and afterwards Britain sold their railway to the world and made a lot of money. And this is big money. Yeah, this is bigger than, in proportionate terms, this is bigger than Microsoft and Bill Gates and so on. It's bigger. It's more basic. Communications revolution. The invention of the telegraph. Do you understand? Yes? This is absolutely revolutionary. In the symbolic date is 1866. This is not the invention of the telegraph. 1866 is the first cable to America. Cable from Europe to America. So you can receive today's news from America. Before 1866, you could receive the news 2 or 3 weeks old. Yeah, if you are organising a war, this is complicated. Oh, well, 3 weeks ago, the enemy was over there. Oh, good. Excellent. Yeah. So the telegraph is absolutely revolutionary in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, and then to America in 1866. Today's news today. Yeah. The postal service, writing letters, you know, just sending letters, extremely important. And Britain is the country which invented the idea of the stamp. Le timbre poste. It sounds like a simple idea, but it's not. You have to invent it. Before the stamp, people used to arrive with a letter. We have a letter for you. Please pay. And so, you know, maybe you paid, maybe you didn't pay. And the idea of paying before with a special stamp was invented in the 1860s. And I have a nice picture of the first stamp. Here it is.
It's not going to work, isn't it? Let's try one or two more possibilities before.
Nope. Rubbish. Okay. So let's have a look at the industrial development then, the actual industry side of it. The centre of the question is textiles. The centre of the question is textiles. Now, before the big industry, the textiles from India were far more advanced than the textiles from England. Very beautiful textiles for the rich were imported from India. But when textile industry began, it was so importing cotton from the south of the United States, what would be later the United States, and producing cotton cloth. This was an absolute revolution for people's health, because cheap cotton means you can change your clothes every week, yeah, and not every year. Yeah? And this was one of the biggest changes in people's health. You live longer. You live longer if you wash. Okay, good idea. Wash and change your clothes. This is good. Whereas people just didn't change their clothes. They didn't have two lots of clothes for a long time. Coal, of course, coal extremely important. Iron. And the result of all this, the bigger factories, the bigger coal mines, the urbanisation, the extreme urbanisation of Britain. In 1850, 50% of British people live in towns. It is the only country in the world where 50% of the population live in towns. The peasantry, la paysannerie, the British peasantry, disappears after 1850. Yeah. Now, I know today the French peasantry has a lot of problems. The English peasantry has no problems. It disappeared after 1850. Yeah. So completely extreme example. And, of course, one of the results was terrible, terrible poverty. The people came from the country to the towns, and there was, of course, no money if you were unemployed. If you were unemployed, well, you just die. You just die. That solves the problem, in a way. The only way, after 1834, the only way you could get help if you were poor was to go to the workhouse. The workhouse, littéralement la maison des pauvres, which fundamentally is a prison. And the theory of the workhouse was very simple. The government decided and wrote down, life in the workhouse must be harder than any job outside the workhouse. Because the elite were convinced that if life in the workhouse was not absolutely terrible, people would go to the workhouse instead of working, because people are lazy. This was the ideology of the time. So the official policy of the workhouse is life must be much worse here than even the worst job outside. And the worst job outside was pretty bad. Yeah. Also, you separate the families when you arrive at the workhouse. You're very poor. You arrive with your husband. You cannot go together to the workhouse. Men over here, women over there. And even until 1920, old people often went to the workhouse and were separated if they had no other solution to live on. Even till the 1920s, the workhouse became a terrible nightmare for working class people who were terrified of the workhouse. Many of the workhouses were later made into hospitals. The building, the workhouse building, was often made into a hospital. And many old people refused to go into these hospitals because they were too frightening, because they used to be the workhouse. This is also a period, the end of the 18th century and the 19th century, where the British invent something else. They invent the trade union, the syndicalisme. Now, I am giving you a long list of things invented by the British, but this is normal. If you have the first industry, you invent everything else which goes with it. And, for example, trade unions, le syndicalisme, is invented in Britain. It goes through different phases. At the end of the 18th century, most of the trade unions are craft unions, des syndicats de métier. Yeah? Only for highly specialised workers who have learnt their job over a long period of time. Tailors, printers, builders, people like this. Very, very, very strict rules for entering. A lot of ceremonies and oaths. Il fallait prêter serment pour rejoindre le syndicat. Very, very serious. And in fact, the government made it illegal to swear oaths. À un moment où ils trouvaient que politiquement c'était difficile d'interdire les syndicats, ils interdisaient de prêter serment. And many many trade unionists were arrested and imprisoned for this. In the 1830s, the famous case of the Tolpuddle Martyrs, les martyrs de Tolpuddle. Oui, je n'ai pas réussi jusque-là. J'ai appuyé sur plein de boutons. Ça n'a pas aidé. The later, after the craft unions, you got the invention of general unions in the 1830s. One union for everybody. Ça c'était excellent. Qu'est-ce que vous avez fait? F2, ah oui, voilà. Merci beaucoup. Ok, maintenant je vais pouvoir le montrer. Ici, je... Oui, j'ai pas l'air malin, mais vous non plus, vous avez pas, vous non plus, vous avez pas trouvé. Hein, je vous signale. Hein. La personne qui a dit oui, moi je sais faire ça. Hein. Ok, right, ok. Railways. Railways. This is in the 1830s. The railways in Newcastle. People were very, very excited about the railways because it was just so new. Some people thought it has no future. It's too fast. People don't want to go faster. And this was an interesting idea. Yeah, that made people say, well, why do we need to go faster? And this is still the case today, you know, when you have, I remember a few years ago, for the first time, 10 years ago, they said, you can have internet on a mobile phone. And many people thought, well, why do you need internet on a mobile phone? And now we can't, I can't live without it. Yeah, just a minute, I'll just check my Facebook. Okay, right, the railways, the first ever postage stamp, the penny black, the very first one. This is a cotton mill, this is an original cotton mill, donc usine de textile, de coton, just near where I used to live near here when I was a child. The textiles were so important. In fact, all of my grandparents worked in textiles. My grandfather worked in the chemicals to make the dye, la teinture. My two grandmothers worked in the mills, in the cotton mills. You know, they started when they were 10. Yeah, very, very hard life. This is an advert offering a reward if you find the people who have broken the machines. A reward for breaking the machines. They were very worried about the machine breakers, and they passed a new law which said that the punishment for breaking a machine was execution. Yeah, capital punishment for breaking machines. Yeah, so they were frightened, yeah? The elite were frightened. Very serious thing, yeah? This is the mythical leader of the machine breakers, Ned Ludd. Notice that he is dressed as a woman. A lot of the rioters dressed as women to do the riots. This is partly a sort of carnival idea, changing. It's almost a kind of magic idea that if you dress as a woman, you will have new different powers. I must try it sometime. Okay, this is Robert Owen. It's a statue of Robert Owen, and he is one of the founders of the general unions of the 1830s. A general union was the idea of one union for all the workers. But the idea of a trade union today, and Sanika today, we have approximately an idea of what trade unions should do and what they shouldn't do today. But at the time, it was necessary to invent trade unions. What should trade unions do? So some trade unions said, what we need to do is we need to replace the bosses. So, for example, you have all these terrible bosses who make us work too hard in building. Instead of that, we will form our own group where we will treat the workers well, a workers' cooperative, and we will compete with them. Yeah, all sorts of different ideas about what a trade union should do. This is the origin of the cooperatives. At the same time as the general unions, some of the trade unions said, no, the aim of a trade union should be to destroy capitalism. We want a revolutionary trade union. And this is the 1830s, the 1840s. And later on, in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, we get more trade unions which resemble what we have today. That is where the essential thing is collective action for better working conditions. And some of the people in the trade union may be revolutionaries, but they do not consider that the aim of a trade union is to completely change society, just to defend the members' working conditions. But this took a long time of deciding, and of course it's a very exciting time. Let's have a look at the British Empire. The British Empire before 1850. Avant 1850. Okay. Now, the British were not the first people to build a modern empire. The Spanish were the first, and the British stole all their ideas. The first period of the British Empire was, let's go and steal the gold from the Spanish. You know, pirates. The pirates were sponsored by the British government. If you give us 20% of the gold you steal from the Spanish, then that's okay. Yeah, they're very, very. The first thing that the British Empire did was steal gold from the Spanish. The Spanish had a huge empire in South America. They had destroyed the Aztec civilization and the Inca civilization. They had destroyed beautiful towns and killed almost everybody in it. Yeah, they were very, very violent and bloody. The British eventually will be just as violent and just as bloody, but they're not the first. After 1588, the British have domination of the sea. The In 1588, there is a symbolic battle between Britain and Spain, and the result is that the British dominate the sea from 1588 until 1914. The British will dominate the sea, and this is a great advantage if you want to have a good empire. First of all, there is the colonies in America from the very beginning of the 17th century, 1600 quelque. The very first colony disappears completely. They all die. One of the reasons is they came looking for gold, and they didn't bring anybody who could build houses or anybody who could grow food. They just came looking for gold, and they all died. The second one was Jamestown in Virginia. That was a little more successful, and discovered that although they found no gold, they went looking for gold, there was no gold. They found tobacco, and they found they could make a lot of money with tobacco, but their solution to make a lot of money with tobacco was slavery. Let's go and get people from Africa and make them work on the tobacco plantations. Now, I think we all agree this is a very bad idea. Why did they do this? Well, it seemed impossible to make the Indians in America work in large numbers on the plantations. The Indians preferred to have a war instead of to become slaves. However, the advantage of going to Africa is you get, not the advantage, the economic advantage of going to Africa is you can take people from different villages, kidnap them. They do not speak the same language. They are taken across the world in terrible conditions. It is extremely difficult for them to resist. There was resistance. There were revolts in the slave ships. There were revolts in the colonies. But in general, it was an economic success. Here are some pictures. What's that? This is them. They are selling slaves when they arrive in America. Absolutely terribly cruel. If one of the slaves is ill, they just leave them to die. I cannot sell you, I will leave you to die. It's absolute. The British Empire is probably the biggest crime against humanity until the Nazis. Before the Nazis, it's probably the biggest one. The slave auction, awful, dreadful, dreadful thing. However, it's not all bad news, because there was also a movement against slavery. In Britain after 1780, the first mass political movement in Britain was against slavery, and this is their badge. Their symbol. They invented the idea of having a symbol, a logo. Yeah, they invented the logo. And here it is. And there you have the slave in chains. Yeah, and he's saying, "Am I not a man and a brother? Ne suis-je pas un homme et votre frère?" Now, today, it's quite easy to criticize. Obviously, the slave is asking for help. It's not, ce n'est pas Malcolm X. It's not Black Power. It's, please help the poor slave. Nevertheless, this was a mass movement. In every town there were demonstrations, lots of petitions, men's groups against slavery and women's groups against slavery. It was a mass movement, and it was one of the elements that led to the banning of slavery the banning of the slave trade after 1807. 1807, le commerce des esclaves est interdit, pas l'esclavage, le commerce des esclaves. Alors si vous avez déjà des esclaves, vous pouvez les garder, hein? And in 1833, the slavery is abolished in the British Empire. This is a castle built by the British in Africa to keep the slaves until it is time for the ship to take them away. You can put 1,500 slaves in there. It's not very comfortable. And here you have the slaves who have been captured. They are attached by a long piece of wood and there you go. Let's look at another part of the... Well, there you have the slave trade itself. 10 to 15 million. We're guessing, yeah, because they didn't leave their names. 10 to 15 million people taken from Africa to the Americas. And the result? Coffee, tobacco, sugar. Coffee, tobacco and sugar are extremely important. Sugar is not expensive today. Sugar is an extremely important commodity, and at the time it was expensive. Tobacco is still important today. There are some people here who would be in a terrible situation. Imagine the price of tobacco was multiplied by 5. Yeah, I know some people here would not be eating any sandwiches. There's only enough money for the tobacco. This is the the other part of the empire in India. In other parts of the world, the British Empire was organized in a different way. They established private companies which were given a monopoly by the king on trade. This is the East India Company, which controlled India for hundreds of years, and had a private army, a private company army, and produced private company money. So it's a rather unusual tactic where a monopoly company was given India. So, okay, the queen said, okay, India is yours. This was not a problem for the king and the queen, because in their mind, these people are not Christians, so they don't have any rights. Yeah, the religious, that gold and religion went together very, 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 very strongly. That's the East India Company controlled India. That's the headquarters of the East India Company in London. And that's not very important. Here is just one of, this is in Glasgow. This is just statues to the glory of the empire. Yeah, because not only did the British organise this huge empire and in India and the West Indies, the Caribbean, is only part of it. Later on, half of Africa, very, very big. They were also very, very proud of it, and they have these wonderful statues for it. Of course, the third part of the empire is Australia, New Zealand, Canada, which will be occupied, the Aboriginals in Australia and New Zealand will not have a good time. And that's another part of it. So you've got, you know, you've got the West Indies, you've got India, you've got the colonies in America, you've got New Zealand, and so on. And I have here for you, before you leave, this is just about the American colonies, the variety. I'm not going to give it you now, but get it on the way out. This is just to explain why the different colonies in America were formed and what happened to them. Because, of course, gold and tobacco were very, very important, but also religious freedom. Many religious groups left England because the Church of England was not giving them enough freedom. And when they arrived in America, of course, they could do whatever they liked, and they did. It was also part of their motivation. We are going to America to build a completely new society according to the principles of true religion. This was a very important motivation, yes? Because also, although life was worst for the slaves, life was also very hard for the people who arrived from Ireland, Scotland, England, who arrived there, very many of them starved to death, and so on. Let's go back to Britain, and we can see now, during the 19th century, the beginnings of the arrival of democracy. Democracy arrives very slowly, and it is absolutely not automatic. Every tiny step is the result of a long struggle. In 1832, the first Reform Act, the government wanted to increase the number of people who could vote. Instead of only the very rich, they wanted it to be only the rich, fundamentally. Very, very difficult. The House of Lords refused, and only when there was a big demonstrations and riots was it possible to have this first very, very small reform. Later on, in the 1830s, came a big movement for the right to vote for everybody, or at least the right to vote for all classes, because most of the movements defended the right to vote for all men. This was not necessarily at the time seen as an anti-feminist idea. The majority of women considered that the man will vote for the family. And so the most important thing for most of the ordinary women was, we need people like us to vote. The demand for a specifically women's right to vote comes a little later. This movement is called Chartism. Chartism from 1838 till 1848. It continues a little bit. It is the biggest political... It is the first national working class political movement in the world. And it's massive. There are hundreds of newspapers, hundreds of groups, hundreds of different tactics The first thing they do is they produce a big petition to ask for the right to vote, yes? Can I spell what? Chartism. C-H-A-R-T-I-S-M. Chartism. It is around the People's Charter. And the People's Charter says we want to vote. We want the secret ballots. The secret ballots. And a few other things. It's easy to find on the internet. The first petition. Huge petition. Hundreds of thousands of signatures. They took it to Parliament. And Parliament said, we don't want to talk about it. Okay. So that was a difficult situation. Huge debates in the Chartist movement. What tactic should we use? Some people said, we need arms. We need to have a civil war. We need to take up arms against this government of the elite. Other people said, no, we don't need to do that. We need to have a strike, what they called a grand national holiday. We need a general strike. We need to refuse to work. That way we can force the government to give us the vote. Other people said, no, that's not a good idea. What we need is we need to go back to the land. We need to buy some villages and some farms so that working people in the towns who have such a difficult life can go back to the villages and the land and farm. You know, a very, very popular idea, the Chartist land plan. It was not a success. Firstly, there were too many workers and not enough farms. And secondly, they were not very good at farming. Yeah. If I take you back to the land, how long will you last? Yeah, you're not very good farmers, and that was one of the problems. Other people said, no, the solution is education. We must establish independent Chartist schools, and they did. They established schools. It was a mass movement. They established schools, very advanced schools. They had schools where boys and girls learned the same subjects. At this time, this was incredibly avant-garde. They had Chartist schools where the teachers did not hit the children. Yeah, they were 150 years ahead of the British education system. And I have some pictures of the Chartists for you. This is just a drawing of a Chartist demonstration. You can see it says, let the people, I don't know what it says, choice of the people, liberty, and so on. And here is a real contemporary poster for a Chartist demonstration to the working men of London. Yeah, Monday next, April the 10th. Yeah, and this is where they're meeting. Yeah, we and our families are pining in misery, want, and starvation. We demand a fair day's wages for a fair day's work. The second stage of Chartism then was a general strike in 1842. And the third stage was the third petition, the third Chartist petition in 1848. The government were terrified. The royal family left London because they thought that the Chartists were going to come and occupy the Houses of Parliament. It was an insurrectionary situation. And of course, 1848 is also the time when there is revolution in Paris, revolution in Prague, revolution in Italy. So, you know, the elite had many reasons to be frightened. This is one of the newspapers of the Chartists. And more and more people can read and write. The Northern Star, they produced newspapers. And every week for 10 years, long debates, this is the solution. No, this is the solution. Really, Chartism was the first mass working class political party. Now, today, we know what political parties do. They were inventing the political party at the time. Meanwhile, life in the factories continued to be extremely difficult, but the government began to make some small reforms. In 1833, the first Factory Act said children under the age of 9 must not work. Okay, there's a great reform. Children under the age of 9 cannot work in the factories. Good. And children under the age of 10 must not work at night. These are the reforms of the times. Yeah? So you can imagine that the situation before was even worse. And finally, employers are obliged to teach children to read and to write. That's the first Factory Act. A second Factory Act in 1844 went a little bit further on. Education is beginning to develop. The church organises schools. More and more children go to school in the morning and to the factory in the afternoon. There are the Chartist schools and other socialist schools. There are the board schools, the government schools. Here is a picture of a board school. This is a government school. Many of the buildings have not changed. This is the original building from 1876 of the municipal schools, because in 1870 was the first act about primary education for everybody. It's a new idea. Many people were against this. Many in the parliament, they discussed, no, it's a very, very bad idea. We don't want workers who can read or write. They will become revolutionaries. This was the sort of debate that was going on. The economy, we are now around in the second half of the 19th century. The economy is very, very successful. I want to come back to the empire and describe two episodes in the life of the empire in the middle of the century, which were and are very, very controversial. First of all, the Great Irish Famine. Remember, Ireland is completely controlled by Britain at this time. Most of the Catholic Irish live on potatoes, because the wheat and the grain is exported to England. And in the middle of the 1840s, there is a big disease, there is a potato disease, and a terrible, terrible famine in Ireland. One quarter of the population die. Another quarter of the population leave the country. We have here a couple of pictures. This is a memorial to the famine in Dublin. It represents the famine. Even today, you can see it's a modern memorial. Even today, very, very important to people to remember the famine. Many, many Irish people consider that the English government did not want to help during the famine. A section of the English elite said, oh, well, if we lose a million Irish people, that's a good thing, you know. We don't like them very much, yeah. Another memorial. This memorial is in America, a memorial to the famine in America. Okay? Interesting idea, because, of course, many, many of the Irish who left Ireland went to America, and going to America became the dream of the Irish. Sometimes people say there are more Irish people in New York than in Ireland. It's difficult to calculate. But certainly there are a lot of Irish people in New York, and it's extremely important to them to remain in touch with Ireland. And the Irish produced a million songs about the day I will go home to Ireland. Yeah, like many, many groups of immigrants, you dream about going home, and usually you never go home. That's the bad news for people of you who have families in this situation. Dreaming of going home to Ireland, and then it's more complicated than you think. And also, of course, you cannot go home, because 30 years later, the country you left has completely changed. And this is what happened to the Irish. Here is one of the most famous songs, Danny Boy, and it's a father singing to his son, "You must leave Ireland, and I will stay here. When you come back, if I am dead, say a prayer for me." This is the Irish laments that my mother hated so much, because her father and her mother loved them. The other episode that I wanted to talk about is India. India is extremely profitable to Britain at this time, but in the middle of the 19th century, in 1857, there is a revolt against Britain. At this time, India is dominated by a small British army, and also by an Indian army where all the officers are English. All the officers are English, but the soldiers are Indian. Because of the way that the soldiers are treated, there is a social explosion, and it goes all across India, a revolt against British rule. The English at home are very shocked. Most of the elite in England believed that the Indians were happy to be dominated by the British. And the Indian revolt of 1857 was a terrible, terrible shock to them. The reaction was extremely violent. It was New City and Bombay. To execute the rebels, what they often did is they tied them to a cannon and shot a cannonball through them. The reason for this is that in some Indian religions, if you destroy the body, you cannot go to heaven or whatever. Yeah, that it has a it was a religious problem for people to have their body destroyed, physically destroyed. And so the British did this.
Des histoires affreuses, t'en veux, en voilà.
100 examples. But I think that's a good symbol, actually, that they chose to execute people in a way that was a tragedy for them in a religious thing. So l'équivalent de tuer des catholiques sans le permettre de se confesser. Encore pire, c'est plus sanglant. I mean, that's the sort of idea. Here we have a couple of pictures. Here's a little picture of the mutiny. Well, you can't see very much there. And this is a painting which I discovered when I was in an art gallery in Leeds. I just saw this picture. Oh, well, I wonder what that is. And it is Britain destroying the Indian Rebellion. Yeah, it is the Britain, brave Britannia, yeah, the symbol of Britain, like Marianne, killing the terrible animal Indians who have revolted against her rule. And underneath here, you can see, here is the poor white woman who has been killed by the tiger. Yeah, this is the imperialist. Nice picture, yes? Nice picture. Okay. Back in Britain in the second half of the 19th century, we now have much more of a fight for women's rights. Really, three important fights for women's rights. Number one, the right to vote. This will advance very slowly. After 1870, women can vote for the committees which run schools. In some parts of the country a little later, women can vote, but only in local elections. And it's all very, very slow. It takes 40 years of campaigns until women can vote in national elections in 1918. It's a very, very patient situation. That becomes a mass movement. It becomes a massive movement. There are other important campaigns as well. The right to education. Women are not allowed to go to university. This is not a mass movement because most women say, well, university, I don't know anybody who has ever been to university, men or women. So it cannot be a mass movement in the 19th century. But it's a movement of a smaller group of women. And what they do is in the 1860s, they build a college, Girton College, in Cambridge. And they educate women in this college. And they have... Ils font des examens blancs. Il y a des professeurs sympathisants de l'Université de Cambridge qui acceptent de faire des examens pour les femmes. Ça compte pour rien, ils n'ont pas de diplôme. Mais c'est pour démontrer au monde que les femmes veulent apprendre. That very important. Very, very violent reactions. In Edinburgh, the first women who studied medicine, when they came to the lectures, the men students were very hostile, and the next day the men came with animals, sheep and goats, because they said, if you can accept women, you can accept sheep and goats, yeah? Which, of course, I mean, it is quite funny, but you can imagine it was really not funny. These were very, very courageous women. Yeah? Can you imagine that sort of situation? The trade unions were changing at the end of the 19th century. More and more ordinary workers who were not highly skilled were joining trade unions. Remember, the three periods of trade unionism: the craft unions, only for highly skilled workers, the general unions, revolutionary unions, and now you have what we call the new unionism, that is ordinary workers, dockers, women factory workers are forming trade unions. And in particular, in 1888, a group of girls, we call the Match Girls, les filles des allumettes, qui fabriquaient des allumettes, which at the time was extremely dangerous work, dangerous chemicals. And they had a strike which became a national campaign. And here it is. Here are a picture of the Match Girls in 1888. The following year, it was the turn of the dockers. Remember, at the time, in the docks, there are very few machines. Yeah, mostly it is really carrying things around, not highly skilled work. And they have a big there's a photograph. We have photographs, 1889. Yeah, there's a photograph of a meeting. Ils ont l'air heureux. Okay. And this is one of the banners of the Dockers. And you can see in the middle, Cardinal Manning, because he was a man of the church, who worked very hard for the strike, to support the strike. This is also the time when the Labour Party is formed. For the first time, now after 1884, most working men can vote, and so the Labour Party is formed. And that will have a long future, of course. And finally, then, I want to go back to the empire, because the empire is transformed after 1880 in that suddenly Africa becomes very interesting to the colonialists. Remember, Africa was very profitable, first of all, for slaves, and secondly, for gold, diamonds, and so on. But it's only after the 1880s that Britain, France, Germany, Portugal, and Belgium decide that they would like to control politically Africa. And so you have what we call the Scramble for Africa, where they have a big meeting in Berlin, and they say, oh, this part of Africa is for you, and this part is for you. No, not you, sorry. But only white people are allowed bits of Africa, sorry. Okay, that was really the situation. They divided Africa and gave it to this bit for England, this bit for France. And, of course, that has been the great tragedy of Africa. And I think I have a picture. No, that's not a picture. That's a picture of the results. This is the British Empire. And you can see Africa. You can see lots of Africa. This is the British Empire, or je ne sais pas, autour de 1910. Yeah? India, Australia, of course, and lots of little bits. Lots of little bits. This will include then so a huge expansion of the empire in the last 20 years of the 19th century. A big war in South Africa with the Boers, la guerre des Boers, against the Dutch settlers for British domination, partly because the gold, there was more gold than we thought. And this is the moment when popular racism in Britain will grow very quickly. Racism was really invented at the same time as the slave trade. It was an invention to justify the slave trade. But it becomes very popular in the last 20, 30 years of the 19th century. There are a lot of very popular racist songs. Yeah, that's, you know, pop songs, but very, very racist ones. Just in general, there are all sorts of ways in which ordinary people can try to feel a little bit more important because they are better than the... We know how this works. Finally, really, I just wanted to say a little bit about ideas, because this developing economy, this developing empire, is also going to really move forward set of ideas. And this is the book by Charles Darwin, The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, 1860-something, which is, of course, absolutely revolutionary from a scientific point of view. For the first time, he will demonstrate that the different species, you know, monkeys and birds and human beings, are not completely separate, that they have the same origin, and that they have been the result of evolution over an extremely long period of time. Most people at the time believed that the Earth was created 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. My mother has a very old Bible from the 19th century, and in Genesis, at the beginning, you have the date at the side. Yeah, c'est le Dieu créa la terre, et à côté, c'est marqué il y a 5,012 ans. People really believed it was only a few thousand years, and Darwin will destroy that. Other people, like the second huge revolution at the end of the 19th century, the Tramdeutung, is the example. This is Freud, yeah, Monsieur Freud, will be publishing his major books in 1898, 1901. Actually, quick, say 1901, that one. And this will transform our vision of psychology. For the first time, Freud will talk about the unconscious, by the subconscious that sometimes we do things and we don't know why, but there is a reason in the psychology. These are just two examples of the advance of ideas in the second half of the 19th century. But let's say that technology and science are accelerating. Yeah, so we have an acceleration during all this period. The result is then, at the end of the 19th century, Britain will really be the most powerful nation in the world for a short while. And next Tuesday, I will tell you what happens next, because the 20th century for Britain is a relative decline, although we do have a lot of fun. Thank you for listening.